Good afternoon. It's 3 o'clock. You are tuned to KTOO News in Juneau here on Friday, the 6th of January of the year 2012. Jeff Brown with you here on a Juneau afternoon. Today we'll talk with Katie Bosler from the University of Alaska Southeast about upcoming classes, plus get a preview of the Sound and Motion series of presentations. We'll also talk with Byron McGilvery and Lena Simmons about Saturday's Midwinter Vocal Festival concert, and we'll get all warmed up for the Anchorage premiere of The Blue Bear with a little reading from Lynn Schooler and his book. That Writer's Almanac Music and more today on a Juneau afternoon. The forecast for tonight looks like rain and snow in the evening, then scattered snow and rain showers later on with snow accumulation up to 2 inches expected, low temperatures around 32 degrees. Forecast for Saturday looks like snow in the morning, then rain in the afternoon.
Native Voice One, the Native American Radio Service.
This is National Native News. I'm Antonia Gonzalez. First Nations in Canada are suing the federal government over the right to education. Dan Karpinchuk has more.
The lawsuit was filed by 28 Anishinaabe First Nations communities in Manitoba and Northern Ontario. They accuse the federal government of breaking a pledge made 130 years ago when they were promised equal education and a school on every reserve when they signed Treaty 3 in 1873. Grand Chief Diane Kelly says Ottawa hasn't lived up to its part of the bargain. Instead of a school on every reserve, many of the Anishinaabe's 15,000 children are often bused outside their communities. And when they do attend schools on the reserves, the communities get about half the funding of public schools. Kelly says after 137 years, it's time to stand up for the children.
You know, we've tried to all different ways to get the federal government to work with us. And, you know, at some point you just have to draw the line in the sand and say enough is enough. Too many children are just not achieving their potential, and the impacts are just too high. We can't wait anymore.
The federal government says it is working to improve Aboriginal education. Recently, a national panel on First Nations elementary and secondary education wrapped up a series of countrywide hearings. The conclusion was that there is a general consensus that immediate action needs to be taken to improve First Nations education. Meanwhile, the lawyer for the First Nation says the lawsuit isn't about money. They want the courts to encourage the government to negotiate and honor its treaty obligations. For National Native News, I'm Dan Karpinchuk.
A public memorial is being held today in Window Rock, Arizona, for Navajo code talker Keith Little. The 87-year-old died Tuesday after battling an illness. Little joined the Marines at age 17 and served in the Pacific Theater during World War II. He was president of the Navajo Code Talkers Association. In this October 2011 interview, he talked about the group.
The association comprises of the Navajo tribal members that serve as a Navajo code talker, voice communication, secret, in World War II with the United States Marine Corps, 1942 to 1945.
Little spent much time raising money for a project to build a museum.
Navajo code talker museum. Telling the stories of World War II as to how the language became prime battlefield communication, coded in Navajo.
A funeral is planned for Saturday. Today we're wrapping up our series on Native health and wellness. This week, a wellness center coordinator on the Navajo Reservation shared tips on fitness and healthy eating. The advice included setting goals and starting a simple exercise plan like walking 30 minutes a day. As we wrap up the week, we head to Anchorage, Alaska, where KMBA's Jocelyn Estes talked to people about their New Year's goals.
My name's Linda McLaughlin and I live here in Anchorage.
And do you have a New Year's resolution?
My New Year's resolution is to try to have a more positive attitude.
My name is Nikolai Holstrom, originally from South Naknek, Bristol Bay area.
And what's your New Year's resolution this year?
I'm 68 years old. I'm trying to stay healthy.
My name is Jessica Johnson, and I'm from Anchorage, Alaska.
And do you have a New Year's resolution?
I don't have a New Year's resolution. I just believe in just one day at a time, and I'm really excited for the new year 2012 and everything. I'm very thankful for what I went through in 2011 and excited just to see what God's going to do in the new year.
My name is Rodney McCord and I'm from Tyonik, Alaska, and my New Year's resolution is to take more vacations, like at least twice a year.
My name is Fanny Young and I want to wish everybody Happy New Year.
My name is Linda. I'm from Anchorage. And I'm on a special diet where in the next 6 weeks I'm going to lose another 30 pounds.
That was a summary of some New Year's intentions put together by KMBA's Jocelyn Estes. During this week in 1975, the Indian Self-Determination and Education Assistance Act was signed into law to give tribes authority over federal programs. This is National Native News. I'm Antonia Gonzalez.
National Native News is produced at the Annenberg National Native Voice Studios in Albuquerque, New Mexico, by Kawanic Broadcast Corporation. Funding by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, the Annenberg Foundation, the Ford Foundation, and the Nathan Cummings Foundation. Native Voice One, the Native American Radio Service.
Time is 3:05 and you are tuned to KTOO News in Juneau here on a Juneau afternoon. First guest is Katie Bosler from the University of Alaska Southeast, here to update us on various things happening at the university. Katie, thank you for coming by.
Good afternoon, Jeff. Good afternoon, listeners. Good to be here.
It is good to be here.
Yeah, you know, we're kind of getting back in the swing of things at the university, the staff, that is. The faculty doesn't return until next week, and the students don't return until the 17th, which is the first day of school. So for those of you who are still meaning to sign up for any classes you might want to take at the university, whether it's just, you know, sort of working on that degree one class at a time or something of personal interest, or if you even want to apply to the university, you can still do that.
It could be a New Year's resolution.
There you go. Higher ed. So higher ed is always a good thing. Lifelong learning. So if you just go to the UAS website, pretty much everything you need is there as far as information. Information on admissions is at uas.alaska.edu/admissions. Just go to the homepage. You'll see on the left there's kind of a choice of bars to click on, and one of them is admissions. You can also just go to campus. We're open. We were closed for the holidays, but we are definitely open from 8 to 6 on weekdays, except for Fridays, 8 to 5. And you just head to the Novotny One Stop, we call it. That's the Novotny building in the middle of the campus. You'll see a welcome sign, and you head in there, and there's a nice desk with people to answer any questions you might have about registering for classes. If you want to find out what classes are available, go to the website again. Just click on the schedule icon, which has one of our biology students kind of holding out some hermit crabs, actually.
Something biological.
Yeah, something biological is on the shore there in front of the Anderson building at Auk Bay. So that's got all your classes online. Also, the printed schedule is around town. It's at cafes, it's at libraries, various gathering places for folks in Juneau. So, we're kind of gearing up for the spring semester, which starts January 17th.
Just right around the corner.
It sure is. You know, January is one of those months, isn't it? Everybody kind of like rolls out of the holidays and goes, oh, okay, we gotta get back to real life.
I gotta remember to sign 2012 on all my checks now.
You doing all right with that?
I've been in bed. For some reason, it's easier than it was last year.
You know, I'm having the same thing. What is that? Maybe it's something about 2012 because we've just been anticipating it for a couple of years now. I don't know.
See whether you're ready for it or not.
Yeah, like most of life, that's for dang sure. The other thing that we're really excited about, Jeff, is we do have our Sound in Motion. Now, this is the third annual Spring Art Series at the university. And this is kind of our spring, I guess you would say, answer to Evening at Egan. Though it's a little more casual, and it's more sound and motion arts oriented. So it looks, as it's kind of shaking out, we have events on not every Friday, but many Fridays between January 13th and April 27th. And the first one, just a week from today, Kyle Pickett, the conductor of the Juneau Symphony, is going to be giving a talk on, his title is Extended Techniques in 20th Century Music, Aleatoricism, Postmodernism, and Whale Songs. So the first January, this goes along with the first January concert for the symphony, which features Alan Hovhaness's And God Created Whales. And this is a really sounds very just fascinating, a combination of orchestra and taped whale songs. And so Kyle will talk about this piece and other orchestral music using extended and unusual techniques. And I would go just to find out what aleatoricism means.
And that's starting this next night, tonight, but a week from tonight?
A week from tonight, 7 p.m., Egan Lecture Hall, free. So we call definitely January's Whale Month because the following Friday, the 20th, Jim Darling, a well-known and respected in Southeast whale researcher, will be giving a talk on his research into humpback whale songs and their differences, similarities across the North Pacific, what it all might mean. So we're really looking forward to January being sort of whale week or month at UAS. And also just want to give people an update in case you're wondering about the whale in front of the Juneau Arts and Culture Center. That's actually the smaller version of the 28-foot, I guess the same one's about 14 feet, the 28-foot original sculpture by Skip Wallen that's going to go somewhere in Juneau, right? Mm-hmm. Well, we are still fine-tuning where we want to put the smaller version that is on loan to the Juneau Arts and Culture Center right now. But we do want to thank everyone who contributed to our fundraising for the UAS whale. The fundraising is complete, so thanks everybody who contributed. And
quick note about Jim Darling. He's not only well-respected here in Southeast Alaska, he's well-known all over the world.
Have you had him on your show before? I imagine he's been here before.
I can't remember. That happens when you get old. But I do know that I read about him in Flip Nicklin's book about whales, recent cover book. Wonderful book.
And they work quite closely, it sounds like, Jim Darling and Flip Nicklin. Right. Yeah, so, and we're excited about the whale in front of the Jack that's, you know, going to be at UAS at some point. And I just lost my train of thought. It must be January. But
because you're having such a whale of a good time.
That's it. That must be the reason. Oh, I know what it was. When the Juneau Empire did their poll of local people about top arts events of 2011, several times the whale was mentioned. And I thought that was kind of cool.
It is.
The whale in front of the Jack. Okay, well, let's move on to a little overview of the rest of our Sound and Motion series coming up. All these events, of course, are free, 7 o'clock Friday nights at the Egan Lecture Hall. Many Friday nights, not all Friday nights. But we're pretty full for three Fridays in February for, we're calling it Film Month. So Greg Chaney on February 2nd will be presenting his Journey on the Wild Coast. Now, of course, that's well known. You've talked to Greg, I'm sure, in this program, and he's shown, the film has been shown in Juneau before, but we haven't really had an Auk Bay region showing.
So, it won Best of Show at the Banff Mountain Film Festival as well.
Yes, which and this is going to be a big month for this movie because it's also part of the traveling big honor on both Greg's film, Journey on the Wild Coast, and Alan Gordon's film, Blue Obsession, were awarded the privilege of being part of the traveling collection that goes around to different parts of North America. And so we'll see what happens with this one, but the annual fundraiser for the student government is going to be the Banff Film Festival here will be the 16th and 17th of February. That's just sort of an FYI, separate from Sound and Motion. But Greg will be showing the entire film because I think if it is in the traveling thing, it's shorter. But anyway, the entire film will be shown at UAS on February 2nd, and then Greg will do a Q&A with the audience afterwards. And
I hope people have their pencils out because there's a lot of stuff to remember.
Yeah. This will all be up on the UAS website, but not until next week because we're still kind of got a short staff this week. February 10th, who knew, but now it's part of Sound and Motion. The Juneau Underground Motion Picture Society's Winter Film Fest, they've been showing out at UAS the week following the usual showing in the last few years, but it's going to be part of our series now. So that'll be the Friday, February 10th, will be the Jump Society Winter Film Fest out at the Egan Lecture Hall. For those of us who might have been just too busy the weekend before and missed it here in town, and also for people who are students, et cetera, out there. And then the 24th of February, this is going to be a popular event in town. This is the third annual. Damon Stubner will show his collection from the Alaska State Film Library. Actually, I should say selection. There's so many incredible treasures in the State Film Library. But Damon will be getting together his selection of vintage films and videos from that from the Alaska State Library, and so that's always a good time. March, I'm calling Miscellaneous Month. The 2nd of March, we have our Bachelors of Arts in Arts Senior Capstone presentations, and these are our five illustrious graduates of the art program this year for 2012, and just fascinating personal stories about their childhood and their artistic influences and how these shaped the personal paths of these individuals to becoming artists or ceramicists or printmakers, what have you. So I've already got a preview of this presentation. I highly recommend it, March 2nd. 23rd, Perseverance Theater is scheduled a diversity panel as part of Sound in Motion. The title is The Landmarks, and that'll be a conversation about cultural identity and place through theater. We'll have more information on that, I think, as we get closer to the event. The 30th of March, Friday, we're looking forward to a community poetry reading at the Egan Lecture Hall. This will be hosted by UAS English students. But unlike last year, where it was specifically UAS poets, we're inviting members of the poetic community to recite your original works. Now, there'll be a sign-up in advance required, and there'll be more information about that on the website as we get closer to the event. But we're looking forward to this community poetry reading out at the university. And then April, we're calling, I guess you'd call that kind of a kickoff to National Poetry Month, because April is turning out to be Spoken and Sung Word Month for Sound in Motion. And, you know, Jeff, we have an a cappella student choir group out at UAS.
I didn't know that.
Yeah, they're fantastic. I understand they're really busy over the holidays. So the 13th of April, they will be performing at the Egan Lecture Hall. They call themselves Alaska Pella. The 20th of April will be the Tidal Echoes launch. That's that UAS Literary and Art Journal showcase, 10th annual anniversary edition of Tidal Echoes. And that's going to feature, I'm really looking forward to this, the work of Gustavus writer and photographer Kim Hecox and Juno artist and photographer Patrice Helmar. So mark your calendars for that, the 20th of April, August, our Tidal Echoes launch. And finally, the final event we have scheduled for Sound in Motion for this year, Jeff, the 27th of April, Tom Cosgrove, storyteller, will be performing Nearly Normal Tales. Now, he's done some traveling around the West, and he's resurrecting the ancient art of storytelling. And Tom says he provides a view of Alaska not often seen in Hollywood productions, and these are his exploration of his nearly normal Alaskan life, which I think that's quite a provocative title. And I think all of us feel nearly or not quite normal most of the time.
We had a character on a program we had called Oyster City Harbor, and one of the characters was Norman Newman Normal.
And he was boring, right?
Oh, no, he's a fascinating fellow.
Okay.
So if you missed some of that information, you could wait till next week and catch it on the University of Alaska Southeast website, or you can catch
right.
it on our website here at KTOO
yeah.
News.
And also, we are developing, of course, the poster. So that's still under in production, but keep your eyes out for the Sound in Motion poster around town as of the next couple of weeks, and that'll have all the information about the Sound in Motion Spring Arts Series at UAS as well.
And Katie Posler, thank you for stopping by the station today. And before we let you go, you're moving from Fridays?
Yes. I on our sister station, KRNN, my alter ego as a volunteer DJ, I will now be taking over Monday Tideline from 5 to 7 on 102.7 as of the 9th. And that just fits in better with my busy university schedule, which, as you just heard, Fridays are there's quite a lot going on.
We're expecting Sister Grace to take your place very smoothly.
Yes. I can't wait.
All right, Katie Busler, thank you so much for coming down. Is there anything you'd like to add I might have forgotten to ask?
I think that's about it for right now, Jeff. Thank you for having me.
time is 3:23. You are tuned to KTOO News in Juneau, and that musical selection was to get us ready to talk to Dr. Byron McGilvery and Lena Simmons about the Midwinter Vocal Festival concert coming up tomorrow at 7:30 at Chapel by the Lake. Byron and Lena, thank you very much for coming down the station.
You're welcome. Thank you.
Good for you to have me again.
Again and again and again. You're welcome anytime.
Thank you.
So what did we just hear?
We heard the Lacrimosa from Mozart's Requiem, if you remember, from Amadeus. That was what was being sung as they were rushing him through the streets. And so this was the Lacrimosa from Mozart.
And this is
and we're going to be doing that. That will be opening the program tomorrow evening. We're going to be doing that piece.
Do you want to go over the program, if you could?
We're going to be doing Wood, a piece by Cecil Effinger with flute. We're doing an arrangement that I did of I Wish You Love. We're doing a piece by Dan Gothrop, Night, Sleep, Death, and the Stars, to a poem by Walt Whitman. We're doing a couple of gospel pieces. And then the other thing is that we've had an ensemble class with working on duets, quartets, trios, and we're going to have that class, the members of that class have all been placed in an ensemble, so they will be also performing. So it's going to be a very varied program.
How many people have been in the workshop so far?
I think we have about 65, somewhere around there, maybe a few more.
Is that a record?
65 and 70.
Is that a record?
No.
No. I think when we
99
did,
was the record. 99 was the record. Elijah. I think
yeah,
Elijah was the biggest one.
We had 99 people.
Do people call you Dr. Music?
Sometimes. My students just, at home I'm just known as Doc. And it's interesting because even the doctors in town, I guess I'm the only one. But I have been called that, our music man.
So, Dr. Music, why does it hurt when I sing?
Why does it hurt when you sing? You're doing it incorrectly. There's tension in your throat.
And the right way to relieve that?
Yawn. When you sing, it's almost like a yawn. And the one thing about if you watched Pavarotti sing, he always had this very openness in his mouth and his throat. And that's the secret, is relaxation. If there's any tension in the throat, it will hurt.
And how long has Byron been up here coming to do workshops?
This is the 23rd Midwinter.
Have you been to each one of them?
Yes, I have. From the very first one where we had 19, 20 people.
Yeah.
It was a small, 23. Sorry. And we sang two pieces. And now we're singing seven or eight. Seven.
And we filled in. We had a lot of filler for that program. And it has been remarkable. You know, this 23-year ride, I'm thinking of all the things we've done and all the things we've been able to do, and some of the people who have come out of our workshops and gone on to do things with JLO and with Opera to Go and the other things that are happening in town, the Bach Ensemble. That's what it's all about, is the growth of the singers, performers in town. And that's what I think that of everything we've done, I'm proudest of that, because otherwise it dies. It reaches a certain point and there's nobody to continue. And we have young people, worked with some today, and they're going to be going on. And 20, 25, or 30 years from now, they're in town, they're going to be doing what we're doing now.
Dr. Music, what happens when you have a cough and you get a concert coming up on Saturday night?
I don't think that no science has ever found, or no scientist has ever found any kind of a recipe or cure for that. Okay. We have a couple who are women, ladies, who sound like basses. And they vow they're going to be ready for tomorrow night. I probably think that they're probably not. But there's not anything you can do. Coughing is hard on the voice. We try not to do that, but there's really not much. There's really not much.
Drink liquids. Some people swear by things like honey with a sprinkling of cinnamon in it.
that just kind of warms up the blood so that it, you know, continues to flow. Some people like warm honey and lemon juice, a little water, and or a little alcohol if you're, you know, put that way, so that it's warm and it trickles down your throat.
The German singer's recipe is one part honey, one part lemon juice. You boil it to a rolling boil, turn the fire off. When the boil goes down, you add one part whiskey, put that into a thermos, and take about a tablespoon as hot as you can stand it about every 20 minutes. Let it trickle down the throat.
What makes these workshops different other than the number of pieces you're doing this year?
Every group has its own individual personality. You know, we have a lot of, we have some people who have been there, done, like Lena, who have done every one. But we have a lot of people who are coming in, and this is their first one. What makes it different is the personnel and the personality of the ensemble. The second thing is the music that we do is geared toward the group that we have. We select the music once I get here. You know, I can say, okay, we're going to do this. But if we get here and we have a whole lot of men, then there's something else that we probably need to do. So we select the music and tailor it around the group. The second thing is that we always have a voice class, a beginning voice class, but the other classes that we have fluctuate. This year we're doing the small ensembles. We've done all kinds of things. We've had a chamber chorale. We've had all kinds of things. And I think the biggest thing is the personnel. That makes a difference.
You talk about the personalities, type A personalities, type B personalities. You have three more years to go before you do the whole alphabet. what personality would you call this group of people? A through Z?
This is an A personality ensemble. And as much as possible, you want an A. You want them aggressive, not passive. But of course, when I fuss at them, they're rarely passive. They look at me and say, "I wish you'd shut up and we go and sing." But not out loud, they don't say that. But you want an A personality. You want a very aggressive personality.
Do you announce at the beginning of the workshop, everyone put your egos away? Or should you?
No, you shouldn't. That's difficult. You don't answer that? That's a difficult question to answer.
Well, in terms of ego, every singer has to have ego. You can't get up there and stand in front of people and produce sound out of yourself without anything to hide behind and not have some sort of an ego, confidence, a surety that you can do this. So you want ego. You want assertiveness. You want people who are going to work because they want to sound good. So, I mean, you occasionally get that diva type that, you know, thinks they're so much better than everybody else and they don't have to listen. But we've been very fortunate over the years. We don't have very many of those. So
I can only think of one occasion in this town that I had that. And
that's when I took your class.
Yes, Jeff, you were the one. Yes.
You the bad apple in the box. That's a, and you know better. And in a school setting or in my professional ensemble, I could take care of that.
And how do you take care of it?
Bye. You know, they just don't get in.
Or they don't get back in.
And the thing is that you're going to have them that come through that think that they're the cat's pajamas. But as she said, you wouldn't. I have no problem with the confidence, and I have no problem with an ego. I have a problem sometimes, and not often, when the ego is greater than the talent, and they're the ones that always have to be out in front. I've had people who, you know, if I didn't get a solo, I won't do it, and I'm just mean enough or ornery enough that I say, okay, you don't do it. even if they were better for the solo than somebody else, I would prefer to foster somebody who is going to be enriching the ensemble and enriching the situation down the line than have somebody who is so self-aggrandizing that they can't play anything other than the major role.
So how do you foster healthy egos?
I think that's... there are always ways that I can knock them down without being nasty about it. It's hard to do in rehearsal because you don't want people to take sides. But normally, I can say, okay, do this, and give them something that I know that they cannot do or will not do well. I say, okay, when you can do that well, maybe you can have the attitude that you have. Otherwise, we'll do it my way.
I'm talking to Byron McGilvery and Lena Simmons about the Midwinter Vocal Festival concert, which is happening tomorrow night, January 7th at 7:30 at the Chapel by the Lake. You're doing seven pieces?
Well, we're doing seven with the chorus, and then we're doing, the ensembles are doing about another eight. So we're doing 15, 16 different pieces.
How do you figure out the order in which to place them?
Oh, it's governed by mood, pace, and timing. The mood that you want to set, how fast you want it to go, and when do you want things to change. A lot of that's governed by what is the key. You don't want two pieces in the same key in a row. What's the meter? You don't want 2, 3, 4 pieces in a row or 2, 6, 8 pieces in a row. You want to keep that variety. And then the subject matter, that makes the flow. You always want to start with something either really, really bombastic or something quiet and contemplative. And you want to close the same way. Most closes are rather bombastic and
ours
big.
Will be Saturday night.
And ours will be Saturday night. Or you want to close with something that is so introspective and just so quiet and controlled that it just leaves everybody almost breathless. A great way to close a program, and I'm letting some of the secrets out of the bag, is to have a bombastic piece, and then if you got an encore, come back with something that is so very tender and touching and quiet and and introspective. That's a great way to close a concert.
Have you got an encore planned?
Normally for this, I do not. Encore means to do over, and almost always we get an encore, and almost always we do something that we did, we do again. We were on with my chorale several years ago now. We were on tour in Asia. We were in Taipei, in Taiwan. And we just done a long concert. And I don't let my singers, my professional singers, I didn't let them eat before performance. And so we did 7 encores and had to come back and do one of the pieces we'd already done again. And finally, before the last piece, I said, "Don't you people have a place to go?" and it was translated, and the audience thought it was great fun. We did 7 encores. And finally, I just took them off stage. They had to go eat eventually.
Midwinter Vocal Festival concert starts tomorrow night at 7:30 at Chapel by the Lake. How can people get tickets, Lena?
Well, you can always go to the Juno Opera website, which is junoopera.org. They're also at Hearthside Books and Rainy Day Books, and always at the door.
And they're $12 and $9. $12 and seniors and students are $9.
Well, thank you very much for coming down to the station. Appreciate it.
Thank you, as always.
And here is the Writer's Almanac for Friday. It's the 6th of January, 2012. It's the birthday of E.L. Doctorow, born in New York City, 1931. His first novel, Welcome to Hard Times, a satire of the Western. His second, Big as Life, science fiction. It was his third novel, The Book of Daniel, that put him on the literary map, won the National Book Award. And Ragtime, which followed in 1975, was a bestseller, and he said, the easiest book that he ever wrote. His latest novel is Homer and Langley, based on the true story of the Collier brothers, who lived in a mansion in Harlem, gradually shut out society after the death of their parents, became recluses and hoarders of junk, 180 tons of it. The brothers died in 1947. Langley was crushed by an avalanche of their stuff, and Homer, who was blind and paralyzed, starved to death. E.L. Doctorow, like everyone else who grew up in New York, knew about the Colliers. He said, "I wasn't the only teenager of the time whose mother looked in his room and said, 'My God, it's the Colliers.'" E.L. Doctorow, once asked about his writing routine, said, "Here's how it goes. I'm up at the stroke of 10 or 10:30. I have breakfast and read the papers, and then it's lunchtime. Then maybe a little nap after lunch and out to the gym, and before I know it, it's time to have a drink." It's the birthday of Barry Lopez, born Portchester, New York, 1945, grew up in Southern California and New York City, author of Arctic Dreams and of Wolves and Men. It's the birthday of novelist Elizabeth Strout, born Portland, Maine, 1956, an eighth-generation Mainer who moved to New York. Her first novel, Amy and Isabel, made into a TV movie by Oprah Winfrey. Her collection of stories, Olive Kittredge, won the Pulitzer Prize, and in between those two books, she wrote a bestseller, Abide With Me. And it's the birthday of one of the best-selling poets of all time, Khalil Gibran, born in a mountain village in Lebanon in 1883, lived in Boston, and that was where the publisher Alfred A. Knopf met him, who then published Gibran's book, The Prophet, in 1923. Here's a poem for today by Jane Kenyon, Staying at Grandma's. "Sometimes they left me for the day. Well, they went, what does it matter where, away. I sat and watched her work the dough, then turn the white shape yellow in a buttered bowl. A coleus, wrong to my eye because its leaves were red, was rooting on the sill in a glass filled with water and azure marbles. I loved to see the sun pass through the blue. You know, she'd say, turning her straight and handsome back to me, that the body is the temple of the Holy Ghost." The Holy Ghost, the uh-oh, I thought, studying the toe of my new shoe, and glad she wasn't looking at me. Soon I'd be back in school, no more mornings at Grandma's side while she swept the walk or shook the dust mop by the neck. If she loved me, why did she say that two women would be grinding at the mill, that God would come out of the clouds when they were least expecting him, choose one to be with him in heaven, and leave the other there alone?" A poem by Jane Kenyon, Staying at Grandma's, from Let Evening Come, published by Grey Wolf Press and used by permission here on the Writer's Almanac, supported by the Poetry Foundation. iPad users can download the three most recent issues of Poetry Magazine, celebrating its centennial in 2012, at poetryfoundation.org. Written by Holly Vanderhaar. Be well, do good work, keep in touch.
Time is 3:42. You are tuned to KTUO News in Juneau. Lynn Schooler's book, The Blue Bear, was adapted into a play by Perseverance Theater. It's performed last year. It's going to be performed this February at Anchorage. It's a little segment of Lynn Schooler reading from his book, The Blue Bear.
The next passage I'm going to read takes place in late October during a trip we made around Admiralty Island to try to photograph whales and that kind of soft autumn light we get. Frederick Sound was calm when we hove to off Eliza Harbor for lunch. I broke out the binoculars while Michio pasted together sandwiches. Then we sat on the foredeck to glass the coast while we ate. The Swift rocked gently from side to side on the remains of a northern swell coming down Stevens Passage. The sea was pale gray. Smoke pouring from the funnel of a ship passing far to the south drew a low smudge along the horizon. After finishing the sandwich, I wiped my face with a paper napkin, went back in the wheelhouse, and flipped the radio to the weather station. We were too far south to pick up the broadcast from Juneau, but I thought on such a clear day we might still be in range of Petersburg, which was only about 50 miles away. The ether crackled, shattering the broadcast into static. After 10 minutes of trying to decipher the electronic voice from the atmospheric hiss and chatter, I gave up and went back on deck and eyed the sky. "The weather still looks good," I said. Gauzy fingers of white were reaching into the sky from the southwest. The rest of the sky was powder blue. "It's a nice light," said Micho. "Now all we need is whales." We drifted for another half hour, watching the horizon for spouts. The light felt good on my face, and it was peaceful to sit and watch the world revolve around us. "High tide's in another couple of hours," I commented. "Maybe when it turns we'll have some luck with the whales." It was a wild guess, more hopeful than realistic, but there was a slim chance that a change in current direction would have some kind of effect on the free swim and feed and thus bring about some activity from the whales, if there were any around. The 20 or 30 square miles of ocean visible from our position seemed as empty as the sky. We idled, moving a mile or two before shutting down the engine, then taking turns watching for whales and napping. Off Chapin Bay, a harbor porpoise puffed to the surface a few meters from the bow and then snatched a quick breath before disappearing again. A handful of storm petrels flicked by, skimming low across the water. The next time I woke up from a snooze, the sky was no longer blue. The gauze-colored fingers of cloud had turned pearly gray, and the Swift was rolling harder, rocking from side to side with a snap that kind of rattled the coffee cups on their hooks. I glanced at my watch. It was after 3 o'clock. The tide had turned more than an hour ago. In another hour, it would be running at its peak. The roll, I thought, must be from the increasing current as it heaved and boiled over the bottom. I checked the pathometer. We were in 100 feet of water, and then snatched a loose book as it made a dive for the floor. The kettle slid across the stove and clanged against the rail. I grabbed up all the loose objects on the countertops and stuffed them in the sink just as the next roll began. "Let's get underway," I hollered at Micho. "I don't like the looks of the sky." A cloud bank the color of a bruise was approaching from the south, a streak of water at its base black with wind. My stomach did a slow flip as I realized the swells rocking the Swift weren't from the products of the tide, but the pulse of something ugly and powerful spinning our way. I flipped a chart out on the table and fingered our position. We'd drifted and idled southwest until we were nearly to Yasha Island, only a few miles from Point Gardner at Admiralty Island's southern tip. The coast nearby was littered with harbors and coves, but they all faced to the south and offered no shelter. Security and Saginaw Bays on the opposite shore of Frederick Sound were ideal for riding out of southerly, but when I looked in that direction, they'd already been obliterated by the fast-moving front. A puff of wind slipped in the open window and fluttered the corner of the chart. The top of a swell broke into a small patch of foam, then behind it another and another, and within a minute or so the seas in every direction were crumbling. A stronger gust of wind shoved the Swift broadside to the swell, and I spun the helm to bring the bow into the waves. Micho looked at me for reassurance. I motioned for him to check that his cameras were safe and put his personal gear away. "It's okay," I said, steering with one hand and jabbing at the chart with the other. "It's only about 9 or 10 miles across Chatham Straits to Warm Springs Bay." Warm Springs is what fishermen call a bulletproof harbor, protected on all sides by towering mountains. The entrance is narrow, and at the head of the bay is a well-maintained dock. Back at the turn of the century, Warm Springs Bay sheltered the village of Baranoff, a small settlement that lured passing fishermen with the promise of a bath and a natural hot springs nearby. And once the fishermen had soaked away the aches and pains of their trade, they could stop off at Sadie Fenton and Fred O'Neill's general store to pick up mail, supplies, and catch the latest gossip from Chatham Straits. By the time I first visited Baranoff back in the mid-80s, the general store was abandoned and collapsing in disrepair. The only full-time residents left were Fred Bohovic and his wife Clotilde. She was 78 and he was 100, and in the process of writing a memoir that he had decided to call My First 100 Years. Micho brightened at the mention of Warm Springs Bay. When we first visited Warm Springs together in 1991, Fred had passed away, and Clotilde was still grieving, but we took her out for a ride anyway, running the Swift down Chatham Straits until we found a pot of whales that sent her into spasms of rapture by lolling on their backs less than 50 yards from the boat and waving their giant fins in the air. By the time we returned to the dock, she and Micho were solid pals. I didn't mention that she had recently been hospitalized in Sitka for cancer of the throat. That could wait, I figured, until we were safe at the dock. It'll be a downwind run, I said. We should be there within an hour. I sounded cockier than I felt. The seas weren't that bad yet. They were running between 4 and 5 feet, but the ebb was running at its strongest and flowing out against the wind. 2,000 square miles of water was moving south in opposition to a rampaging air mass that was probably the size of Tennessee, in a combination that could only agitate an already churning sea. When I remembered that Sadie Fenton had sold the general store in Baranoff and moved on because Fred O'Neill disappeared and was presumably sunk and drowned after heading out into Chatham Straits in weather much like this, the Swift began to feel the size of a gnat. Although it was not yet 4 o'clock, the light outside had a gray, gloomy weight, and when a gout of spray rattled across the windows, I flipped the switch for the windshield wiper and thumbed the radar on. We idled, jogging into the chop while I considered what to do. From our present position, a straight-line course to Warm Springs Bay would take us across an area of shallow water between Yasha Island and Point Gardner that's subject to ferocious tide rips. Otherwise, we'd have to head southwest into the seas until we could clear Yasha, then come around 120 degrees. This would entail some heavy pounding and add another half hour or more to the time it would take to reach Baranoff. We might not reach shelter until close to dark. Another bucket of salt water broke against the windows. I tightened the dogs on the door. On the radar screen, the coastline was blurred by the scatter of breaking waves, and when a smear of green fog appeared, I knew it meant heavy rain. I spun the wheel, corkscrewing the Swift around, and settled on a course for Point Gardner. A downpour heavy enough to obscure the radar also meant nightfall was coming early, and running in the dark is fraught with risk. Industrial-scale logging back in the 70s and 80s had littered the waterways of southeast Alaska with thousands of abandoned logs, and striking one in a boat as light in the Swift at night could be fatal. I eased the throttle forward, pushing the Swift until she was running with the waves. The seas were running about 5 feet, with every so often one pushing 6. Quartering the seas was almost exhilarating, with the Swift rising over one wave and surfing down its face, then powering to the top of the next. Michio braced himself against the table and stared over his shoulder at the waves. "It's liable to get a bit rougher up ahead," I said, staring at the radar. There was something on the screen I'd never seen before. The area between Point Gardner and Yasha Island was writhing like a green snake. A knot formed in my stomach when I realized what it was. The tide pouring out of Stevens Passage and Frederick Sound was boiling up over the shallows and hurling itself headlong into the flow from Chatham Straits. What I was looking at was an area of steep breaking waves spaced so closely together that the radar was seeing it as one wave. "Brace yourself," I said. I tried to sound calm but spoke too loudly. I was wondering if it was too late to turn around. It was. There was nothing to do but hang on. The Swift dropped off the first wave and plunged into the trough and clawed its way back to the top. Waves charging madly in every direction slammed into each other, erupting into pointed peaks. Green water foamed in over the rail. Blowing scud quickly overpowered the windshield wiper, and I was reduced to peering through the streaks. Somewhere ahead of us, a steel buoy marking the end of a reef extending north from Yasha Island was bobbing and ducking in the boiling water, and if I missed it, the Swift could be swept onto a patch of submerged boulders and torn to pieces. A drawer leaped free of its tracks and crashed to the floor. "Leave it," I barked when Michio made a move to pick it up. Water was sloshing across the deck and seeping in around the door, making the cabin's hole slippery. I just didn't want him getting thrown and hurt. "We'll be through this soon," I said. "The tide'll flush us out the other side." I risked taking one hand off the helm to adjust the radar screen and realized I was clenching my teeth. The chaotic wave train and blowing spray were overwhelming the radar's performance, making it difficult to discern water from land. All I could do was guess at a rough heading, try to hold it, and pray we'd claw our way toward deep water before we were pushed up on that reef. The noise was fearsome. Spray rattled off the windows like falling gravel while waves sledgehammered the hull. The beating seemed to go on, banging and tumbling the Swift until it felt as if she were falling down a flight of stairs. "There!" Michio shouted, pointing off to port. I caught a brief glimpse of red as the missing buoy bobbed to the top of a wave. A few minutes later, the spray eased for a moment, and the long green finger of Point Gardner appeared on the radar screen. We were less than 2 miles away, with the buoy passing astern, and as I watched the depth sounder flash from 20 fathoms to 40 and on down to 50, I knew we'd been swept past the reef. "We're almost out of it," I said, in an effort to reassure Michio. "This'll get better as soon as we clear the point." I couldn't have been more wrong. It had taken us nearly half an hour to work our way through the tide rips, and in that time the wind had doubled. The waves were stacking up, beginning to climb one atop the other and breaking for 100 feet along their crests. Jesus, I muttered. My heart was racing. My breath was coming in pants. The Swift is a light, shallow-draft boat, and the cabin creates a lot of windage. Warm Springs lay west by north on a magnetic bearing of 285 degrees, but to reach it without being blown past, I estimated I'd have to steer off by at least 40 degrees, which would mean crabbing across the wind, running broadside to the waves. "We can't make it," I told Micho. He didn't say anything, just stared at me with his mouth open wide. "We'll have to run north up Chatham Straits," I said. "Try to find shelter on the Admiralty side." The Swift plummeted into the trough between two waves. I pointed the bow downwind and gripped the throttle. One virtue of a gas engine over a diesel is the faster response to the throttle, which simplifies running in big seas. Faster acceleration gives the operator thrust on demand, and with a bit of experience, most small boat skippers develop a sense of timing that makes knowing when to power up the back of one wave and when to idle back to surf down the next as almost an instinctive interaction with the rhythm of the moving water. After that, it becomes a matter of keeping a close eye on the pattern of the wave train to pick the safest course through the swells. But conditions were now far beyond that, and as if to accentuate the severity of our situation, the next wave to pass under the Swift's keel exploded in an avalanche of foam. We dropped like a falling elevator, smashed into the trough, and slewed sideways to the top of the next swell. I jammed the throttle forward, powering the bow around before the next breaker could roll us. We pitched, plunged, and rolled. A heavy duffel bag thumped to the floor. "Get everything down," I snapped. "Put everything down on the floor." I felt bad about barking orders, but moving the gear and heavy camera bags off the bunks and shelves to the floor was a measure of how desperate I was becoming. Shifting 200 or 300 pounds would have only a minimal effect on the Swift's overall balance, but if we were broached and flung sideways by a large break in sea, lowering the center of gravity by even a small amount might make the difference between being rolled over and staying upright. I risk a quick glance at the chart. 8 miles to the north, Wilson Cove formed a shallow indentation in the coast, but it was studded with rocks and too open to offer much shelter from the storm. 7 miles farther, Whitewater Bay promised excellent shelter, but a reef that's been claiming boats since the Russian occupation blocked the southern half of its mouth. Clearing the reef would mean running past the bay, then doubling back in a risky maneuver that would put us broadside to the waves. Another breaker hissed under our keel and dropped us into the void behind it. The best I could do was throttle up to gain speed in the trough, then idle back to avoid skidding out of control down the face. The waves had grown so large and steep I was worried we might drop off the face of one, burying the bow. If that happened, the next wave might throw us end over end. Every fourth or fifth wave was a monster, a slick gray animal that rose so high it seemed to block the wind. I was sure it was only a matter of time until one fell on top of us and drove us under. 16 miles, I whispered. It might as well be 100. I didn't want to think about it. If we didn't make Whitewater before dark, it was another 4 miles on to the next harbor. Shike Bay had no threatening reef, but I figured every additional mile we had to run in the dark doubled our odds against making it. "Is it getting worse?" Micho asked. He was wedged into the corner of the galley, bracing himself against the table in the bulkhead with his hands. "Don't let him see how scared you are," I thought to myself, and then swallowed and tried to lick my lips. "Don't worry, Micho. The Swift's a good boat." He nodded a little doubtfully and then stiffened as we hit the next wave. But when I glanced at him a few minutes later, his chin was tucked to his chest and his eyes were closed, and his breathing was regular and even. "Jesus," I thought, "he's fallen asleep." Halfway between Wilson Cove and Whitewater Bay, the tide turned and brought with it an incremental drop in the wind, but even though the change took the frenzied edge off the seas, I was still too disoriented by the darkness and the pounding to chance round in the Whitewater Reef. It took another long hour of running at quarter speed before I put the helm over to Intershike Bay. It was past 8 o'clock and flat dark before we tucked the Swift into an 8-fathom hole behind a small island, where the only sign of the storm was a gusty wind sighing through the trees. I was numb, trembling with fatigue, and my shoulders felt like I'd been beaten with a plank. By the time I got the anchor set and gathered up the contents of a cooler that had been tumbled across the deck, Micho was bread and cutlets and had a pot of rice on the stove. I tipped a kettle of water into a bowl and gathered up a washcloth and soap. I was sticky, clammy with fear and sweat, and when I went out on deck and stripped off my shirt, the cool air felt good on my skin. Shivering more from the dissipation of adrenaline than the chill, I upended the bowl of warm water across my chest and let out a satisfied groan. The smell of Michio's cooking mingled with the salty tang of seaweed and kelp. Blowing rain glistened in the light from the cabin. I felt safe, overwhelmed with sensations, and whistled as I toweled myself dry, thinking how good it was to be alive. Michio leaned his head out the door of the cabin and hollered, "Dinner's ready." I snagged a beer from the cooler, slipped on my shirt, and went inside. Michio had performed his usual miracle, producing bowls of salad, rice, steamed beans, and a platter of pork cutlets fried to a crisp golden brown. I twisted the cap from the beer, and the contents foamed up over my hand. "I'm not the only one that got shook up," I thought, and grabbed for a napkin. "Weren't you scared, Michio, when it started getting rough?" I was still amazed by how he had fallen asleep. "Yes," he answered nonchalantly, forking a cutlet onto his plate. "But you said everything would be okay, so I went to sleep." When I reassured Michio that he didn't have to worry because the Swift is a good boat, I was dissembling, but he had accepted my words at face value. He trusted me. It was as simple as that. And as we worked through the meal, I wondered how a person learns to trust like that. In the past, I had wondered at Michio's effect on other people, at how something about him seemed to inspire unexpected generosity and kindness. But now I began to understand that by simply believing in people, Michio's faith created its own guarantee. "You reap what you sow," I thought to myself. It's a common tenet of pop psychology that humans usually respond to the expectation of others by meeting them. Treat a man like a thief and he'll steal. Put him in a straitjacket and sure enough he'll go mad. But the opposite's true as well. And from there it was a short leap to comparing Michio's outlook on life, that the world and its people were basically fair and good and could be counted on to do their best, to my own, which was more like that of someone crossing a powerful river on a skein of thin ice. I ought to be more like that, I thought, and made a half-hearted resolve to emulate Michio's unspoken faith that everything we need is at hand. "Besides," said Michio, stuffing a spoonful of rice into his mouth, "if I didn't go to sleep, I was going to get seasick."
In school, a reading from his book, The Blue Bear, will have its Anchorage premiere this February. You're tuned to KTOO Juno. We broadcast at 104.3 FM in downtown Juno and Douglas. KTOO also broadcasts on these translators. In the Valleynock Bay Area, tuned to K276 AF at 103.1. In Lemon and Spencer Creek, K269 AO at 101.7. Gustavus listens on K201 AM 88.1. K220 BT serves Huna at 91.9. In Excursion Inlet and Icy Strait, you can hear KTOO on K210 AS at 89.9. Online at www.ktoo.org. Thanks for tuning in to Juno Afternoon.
From NPR News in Washington, I'm Jack Speer. The U.S. economy gained 200,000 jobs last month, and the unemployment rate fell to 8.5%. As NPR's Chris Arnold reports, President Obama welcomed the better-than-expected news.
The president had some good news to share when he spoke at the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau in Washington.
Now, altogether, more private sector jobs were created in 2011 than any year since 2005.
The president said, though, that after losing more than 8 million jobs during the recession, there are a lot of people out there who are still hurting.
We have a lot more work to do.